I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo.
Hacemos un llamado al gobierno, a los países del mundo que nos ayuden. Mire, aquí se necesitan máquinas, la fuerza humana no va a dar basto.
Those were survivors pleading for international help after two powerful back-to-back earthquakes rocked Venezuela's central coast on June 24th. Venezuela was just starting to emerge from its historic humanitarian crisis when the quakes slammed the capital, Caracas, and especially the state of La Guaira, where hundreds of buildings collapsed. The disaster killed at least 4,000 people. Some 50,000 are still missing. The catastrophe was made worse by shoddy construction and a weak government response. Because Venezuela's regime looks so ineffective in the emergency, the U.S., whose special forces, you'll recall, arrested Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro earlier this year, will likely bear the lion's share of rebuilding the country. The Trump administration has so far committed $300 million, but billions will be needed and may come from the new Venezuelan oil production President Trump says he is directing. But where will this leave the push for democracy in Venezuela and those new elections so many want? As always, we'd like to hear your thoughts on this crisis. Do you have family or friends affected by the Venezuelan earthquakes? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now to unpack all this is Simon Romero, a veteran Latin America correspondent for the New York Times who has covered Venezuela for decades. Also with us is Moraima Garcia, a Venezuelan expat community leader in Palmetto Bay who was in Venezuela when the earthquake struck. Welcome to you both. Moraima Garcia, we're glad you're back safely. You were in western Venezuela when the earthquakes hit, but you had family back in the Caracas area where the quakes did cause destruction, and you had to make your way back there by land. How is your family there, and what can you tell us about what you saw these earthquakes do and the suffering they caused?
Hi, team. Thank you for having me. Yeah, I was in Venezuela. It was very, very tense. We couldn't contact everyone at the beginning. It took several hours of trying to communicate with them because obviously all the communications were down. People didn't have electricity or ways to communicate. So it took a while to find out. Fortunately, my family is all good, safe, but we do have friends and neighbors that were affected. Whole families died in the tragedy.
How would you describe what you saw, though, as you moved through that Caracas area and La Guaira that was so badly hit by these quakes?
Well, you could see that the environment was like awake. It was, everything was closed. People were, you could see collection centers in every corner of people on their own trying to collect supplies for people. There was still, a lot of questions about what the government was doing and why nothing was happening on their end, why they weren't sending a strong response. So it was very tense and very difficult to be in Caracas at that time.
Yeah. Simon Romero, as I mentioned, you're a Venezuela veteran, and you know as well as anyone the circumstances that made this earthquake disaster and its aftermath worse. What has stood out to you most in these past 2 weeks, especially the questions about all those buildings in La Guaira that collapsed?
Well, Tim, that's a great question. This really just seemed like a disaster foretold almost. I mean, all of the authorities in Venezuela knew exactly where the earthquake fault lies. Venezuela has been through this before. Immediately after this, these two earthquakes hit, I began hearing from friends in Venezuela who, some of them were reminiscing about how similar this was to the earthquake that struck the country back in 1967.
Seven, right. Mm-hmm.
And it hit in exactly the same places in eastern Caracas, neighborhoods like Los Palos Grandes. And it really just struck me as incredible the lack of of preparation to deal with something like this. If you just draw a comparison with countries, very distant places like Japan or places that aren't so distant like Chile, which are much more prepared in terms of building codes, in terms of preparing for disasters like this, in terms of having first responder agencies at the ready, ready to act immediately. And that's something that we just did not see in Venezuela this time around.
Simona, I wanted to ask you just quickly, what we've witnessed with this regime in Venezuela for the past quarter century, one of the awful things is just the sheer raw corruption that has stolen billions of dollars from the public coffers in Venezuela. How badly did that end up affecting the preparedness, as you put it, the lack of rescue and recovery tools and equipment at the ready, for example, that should have been there for a disaster like this?
I think that what we're seeing is just how this dysfunction affected every single level of the response. Instead of actually having, official first responders on the scene trying to dig people out of the rubble, what you saw were civilians doing that job.
With their bare hands in often cases.
With their bare hands in place after place. And this went on for days on end. And it just speaks to the desperation that people had. They had to take things into their own hands to deal with this.
Right.
And this just isn't surprising. I mean, Venezuela has been through a lot in recent years, in recent decades. Just one blow after another. The economy seemed to finally be on the cusp of a real, actual recovery. And then this happened.
Right.
So you had so many people who have left the country, so many skilled people who are not living in Venezuela anymore. So a lot of those agencies that would normally respond to something like this have been hollowed out. They were just not able to respond.
The country
properly.
Was bereft of what it needed in that regard. Yeah. Moraima Garcia, along those lines, we've heard a lot of criticism about the Venezuelan government's response to this disaster, that it was basically AWOL. And when it wasn't AWOL, it was obstructing U.S. and international rescue and relief efforts, or that soldiers and police were even looting goods from the building rubble. Based on what you saw on the ground there, Moraima, what are the biggest problems people are facing as they try to recover, especially the 17,000 who've been left homeless?
Yeah, I think the problem has been that since there's not a coordinated response, for example, we still have people sleeping in the streets near their buildings because they have nowhere to sleep in, and the government has not found ways to house them or to put them in some place where they could at least have, running water and things like that. So that's a big problem. We have also problems with possible outbreaks of illnesses because you have piles of corpses, rotting in between the rubble. So water, electricity, internet access, all those things are very difficult to get. So they are really at the mercy of whatever the government can do, or in this case, themselves and the private companies in Venezuela and international support.
Right.
We don't get anything from the government.
Moraima, were you able to see for yourself how some of these buildings collapsed? I don't know if you were actually in La Guaira or not, but were you able to see evidence of, what we were saying before, the subpar construction over the years in Venezuela in these collapsed buildings?
I did not go to La Guaira. It was closed after I managed to get back to Caracas. It was closed. However, I did see in Caracas, in Los Palos Grandes, and actually the place where I was staying, there were signs of the earthquake. Fortunately, there was no structural damage, but I do have friends that they basically had to evacuate their buildings in Los Palos Grandes.
Right.
So that's the area where I saw it. But the buildings there are not, as feeble as the ones in La Guaira that
exactly.
collapsed.
Yeah.
It's a problem. We have not the experience to deal with this because it's every 50 years or so that we have an earthquake. So people are not prepared.
Right. Simona Romero, you wrote a very insightful article this week for the New York Times about what it's going to take to rebuild this heavily populated region of Venezuela after these earthquakes. You point out the Trump administration has so far committed some $300 million, but experts estimate about $7 billion will be required since, as you also point out in your piece, President Trump claims to be, quote, running Venezuela today. What is the U.S.'s obligation there, and how are we going to fulfill it? Oil money?
Well, you know, the United States is just extremely involved in what's going on in Venezuela right now, whether it likes it or not. And this is because of the new political arrangement that has that is now existing in Venezuela since the beginning of this year, when U.S. forces went into the country and ousted the former leader of Venezuela, seized him and brought him to the United States to stand trial. Mm-hmm. Since then, the U.S. has effectively taken control over the lifeblood of Venezuela's economy, which is the oil industry. So it controls all of the money that Venezuela gets from exporting oil to different places around the world. You know, just a very conservative estimate of what it's collected so far is about $8 billion just in the first 4 months of this year.
Right. Which more or less matches that damage estimate that I just mentioned.
It does more or less match that damage estimate, although those estimates might also climb in the days ahead. Like, no one really has a really strong grasp on exactly how much funds Venezuela is going to be needing to rebuild. So the good news is that Venezuela does have resources. It has an oil industry. However debilitated and weakened it has become, you know, that industry still generates money for the country. Yeah. I guess kind of the bad news for Venezuelan authorities, for the Venezuelan political system, is that they don't control that money. That money is deposited into accounts at the United States Department of the Treasury, which then transfers that money back to Venezuela. And no one really has an idea as to how that works, you know, who's exactly managing that money, how much is being sent to Venezuela, and in what intervals or with what delays. Yeah. There's very little transparency about that. But one thing is for sure, Venezuela needs those funds urgently, if it is built.
You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Simone Romero of the New York Times and Venezuelan expat Moraima Garcia about the catastrophic earthquakes in Venezuela and how, or if, the already crisis-torn country can recover. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Moraima Garcia, this week I reported on the remarkable online effort Venezuelans there and here have coordinated to help locate missing persons or get relief amid that lack of government help. It's reminded a lot of people of the grassroots online effort that helped prove the regime lost the 2024 presidential election, for example. So how important is the Venezuelan diaspora, Moraima, going to be to pulling Venezuela out of this catastrophe?
Is going to be critical. The capabilities to set up these online platforms, to manage them, to organize them, is something that Venezuelans have learned to do. In the absence of a state, of a government that does something, we have learned to do it by ourselves. The same way we monitored the election and the fraud, we're able to connect the needs of people in the ground with donors and with organizations that can support. It's going to be critical, and it's really not stopping. Mm-hmm. I see it. I have at least three organizations that I know of that are very heavily involved, and every day there's more and more people getting involved on helping.
Right. Simone Romero, in your article this week, you also point out the parallels between this Venezuelan disaster and the Haiti earthquake disaster of 2010, which you covered. One thing, sadly, that marked that tragedy was how dysfunctional the U.S. and international recovery aid effort turned out to be. What do we have to do differently this time?
Tim, that's a great question. You know, I spent a lot of time on the ground in Haiti right after the earthquake and in the months and years after as well. And so I saw that whole reconstruction effort take place. And, you know, Haiti really emerged as something of a cautionary tale, you know, after so much money was pumped into the country. You know, the U.S. alone dedicated about $3 billion to the reconstruction effort in Haiti. And it did save lives on an immediate level. It did make that crucial difference. But From a longer-term point of view, it didn't really address the core of the problem in Haiti, which is the government dysfunction and corruption, which really has been enduring really until this day. There were also other problems. There were cost overruns. There was a lot of inefficiency involved. So something that people are really drawing from the Haiti experience is that bigger isn't always better, perhaps.
Good point. Good point.
When it comes to a disaster response. And of course, Venezuela and Haiti are very different countries. Haiti is much poorer than Venezuela, despite all of the problems that exist in Venezuela today. There are really kind of like dramatic needs that Haiti has, which is really different from many other countries in the region. But the similarities are also really quite haunting between the two tragedies. Substandard building codes in both places, and also the official response, the public response that I saw in Haiti was also that civilians were leading the way in Haiti on the ground, just as they have been doing in
Right.
Venezuela
And so
the last couple
perhaps
of weeks.
more focus on steering more of that aid toward that grassroots presence rather than official channels. Would that be accurate way of putting it?
Absolutely. A a
Yeah.
absolutely right.
Right.
That's exactly accurate. You bet.
Moraima Garcia, for a lot of Venezuelans like yourself, the Venezuelan regime's disappointing response in this disaster has been a reason or another reason to urge President Trump to move more quickly to bring democracy back to the country. On the sidelines, we've been watching the controversy over Democratic opposition leader Maria Corina Machado's efforts to return to Venezuela and the Trump administration's efforts to block her. Do you fear this disaster will only delay new Democratic elections even further?
Absolutely. Delcy and her team are going to do everything possible to use this tragedy
Right.
to stay in power.
Delcy Rodriguez being the acting president of Venezuela right now. Yeah.
Correct. They are going to try that. They're experts at this. They've done it over and over, where they take advantage of the circumstances to entrench themselves. And definitely the support from the Trump administration, we've seen the business attaché in Venezuela, John Barrett, taking pictures with Diosdado Cabello, who is
The interior
one.
minister who is indicted himself in the U.S. For drug trafficking charges.
Exactly. And they're working together as if they're, best friends. So this is very frustrating. We really see a need for Maria Corina to come back and help lead her organization.
Simone Romero, in the 30 seconds we have left, where do you see this disaster and the lengthy recovery effort ahead, putting the redemocratization effort in Venezuela?
Well, I think the first thing we have to remember is that this rebuilding and reconstruction effort is going to take years. It's something that's going to happen over the long term. And the second point that I have to make is that many people don't realize this, but authoritarian rule still exists in Venezuela.
Exactly.
That means that the government in Venezuela is not accountable in the way that our own government is. It doesn't respond to investigations by the news media. It doesn't respond to an independent judiciary. It doesn't respond to civil society in the form of NGOs, that are doing their good work on the ground. They don't respond. They don't have to respond to any of that. So that is something that concerns me a little bit. What is the official government response going to be when they don't have to deal with those things. They can run things on their own, and that's certainly how they hope to continue doing things there.
Right. Simone Romero is a veteran Latin America correspondent for the New York Times. Moraima Garcia is a Venezuelan expat community leader in Palmetto Bay. Many thanks to you both. Still to come, a retired Miami-Dade judge finally sees his mental health recovery center vision become a reality. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Back when he was a Miami-Dade County judge, Steve Lifman had an epiphany. While presiding over a criminal case whose defendant suffered from schizophrenia, he realized the criminal justice system here was ill-equipped to handle the mentally ill, even though more than two-thirds of the people in Miami-Dade County jails had mental health issues. As a result, Lifman spearheaded changes in how the system approaches those cases. Arrests dropped significantly, so did the jail population. Lifeman determined the last and most important piece of the reform was a mental health treatment diversion center for criminal offenders. Miami-Dade voters approved $50 million for the facility 2 decades ago. For years, though, it failed to win county approval to open until last month. Now, the Miami Center for Mental Health and Recovery is set to become a reality next year. How it will be funded in the years ahead remains an anxiety, but even so, Lifeman's vision will be the first of its kind anywhere in the world. What are your thoughts about this long-awaited mental health facility? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now here in the studio is retired Miami-Dade County Judge Stephen Lifeman. Judge Lifeman, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you take us back to that criminal case that involved the schizophrenic man and how it moved you to call for reform in how Miami-Dade's criminal justice system approaches the mentally ill? Remind us when this happened.
Sure. This was in January of 2000.
Mm-hmm.
So what,
a quarter
20,
century
yeah,
ago. Yeah,
it's hard to believe. I had long black hair back then.
And, so did I.
At the time in Florida, judges had no training on how to identify someone with a serious mental illness, how to talk to people with mental illnesses, or what to do with their cases.
Mm-hmm.
My experience when something like this, I was being brought into the courtroom by the judge whose division I was taking over, and she said, Steve, if they act strange or bizarre, order a psychological evaluation. Good luck. And she left. That mm-hmm. was the extent of my knowledge. And I was handling what we call a misdemeanor jail division at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people still in custody on low-level offenses. And there's three kinds of people in that division. There are those with attached serious felonies who are not allowed out of custody. There are those that are just too poor to bond out of custody. But mostly, it was people with serious mental illnesses that didn't know how to get out of custody. And so what we would do is if there was any sign or symptom, we would order an evaluation to see if they were competent to stand trial.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was getting ready to go on the bench one morning, and the lawyers came to see me, and they said, look, there's this really intense case, and the defendant's parents are here. Would you mind talking to them? So I brought this lovely couple into my chambers. They were very sophisticated, very well off, and they were just terribly distraught. The mom was crying, the dad was shaking, and they told me that their son, who they told me was brilliant, had gone to Harvard. He had a late onset of schizophrenia, and he was now homeless, and he was cycling in and out of the criminal system.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was a new young judge, and I was all determined I was going to get him help. I promised them I would get him help. And I was getting ready to go back into the courtroom. The mom stopped me, and she said, there's one more thing I need to tell you about my son. She said, not only is he brilliant, but respectfully, he probably knows more about the mental health system than you do. I looked at her. I was kind of confused.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, excuse me? And she said, oh, you see, my son is the former head of psychiatry
at
Jackson Memorial Hospital.
I remember, right.
And you know, you could imagine. And I went in and I called his case and I didn't know what I was doing. And I probably caused him to have a full-blown psychotic episode in court.
And in the end, you had to release him.
That was the worst part of it all.
Right. So what sort of changes went into effect at that time as a result of this, and what sort of effects did they have that made you and the county realize this was the right direction to take?
So we set up, as a result of his case, a pre- and post-arrest diversion system. We've now trained over 9,500 police officers in Miami-Dade at all 36 departments how to identify people in crisis, how to de-escalate, and where to take people. We then set up a post-arrest diversion system. We changed the screening tools at the jail, and we identified who needed help. And if it was a misdemeanor, we stopped ordering these psychological evaluations because the court would lose jurisdiction and just release people back to the street floridly
right.
psychotic. It was absurd and dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So we directed them into treatment. Well, it worked. The number of arrests in Dade County, as you mentioned, were reduced by more than half.
Right.
Yeah, from 118,000 to 53,000.
And almost the same
in the
result
jail.
For the jail population.
Correct.
Right.
And we closed a jail. We saved so far taxpayers $239 million.
Right.
But, and our recidivism also went down from about 75% to 20%, but we were stuck with this small group who were just too sick mm-hmm. for the services that existed.
Okay, so that then is why a bona fide mental health recovery center for the purpose of diverting criminal defendants with mental health issues like you've just described, that became such an important component to this vision of yours.
Absolutely, because it was a small group that mm-hmm. was killing the whole system. And the way to look at it is we should look at it like any other illness, like cancer. You have stage one through stage four. Well, people with serious mental illnesses have different acuity levels and different needs. And what we know today that we didn't know 20 years ago is that for people who go long periods in psychosis without treatment, the gray matter in the brain gets destroyed mm-hmm. and they're becoming permanently disabled. And so you have this small group of individuals who have been homeless for decades, that their brains have been on fire and they are right. very, very sick. There's nothing for them in the United States.
And so a center like this was the end. Were you surprised back in 2004 when Miami-Dade voters approved the referendum to raise $50 million for this center?
No, because, you know, the media was great. They were explaining to people what an issue. And, you know, everybody knows somebody with mental health issues. And mm-hmm. I think the community understood it in some ways better than some of the current politicians.
So what, from your vantage point then, happened? Why did this mental health center project that Miami voters said they wanted and which has been ready to be open for years at a renovated state building at Northwest 22nd Street and 7th Avenue in Miami, why did it suddenly fall into a two-decade-long holding pattern?
Yeah, it was pretty frustrating because we were at the one-inch yard line ready to get it done, and we got hit with politics. And I think part of the problem, and if there was a lesson to any of this, that if you're going to do something this big and bold, you want to try to get it done with the elected officials you started with, because it became like an adopted child for other people. They just didn't care as much. They mm-hmm. didn't know as much. They then had to get reeducated in the issue, and it wasn't their child. And they never really firmly embraced it. And so we had to almost start all over again, re-educating people on the importance, because you have to put this in context. The county is spending $570 million a year,
yeah.
of which $414 million a year is dedicated for people with mental illnesses in the jail. This is a fraction of the cost. And in jail, there's no Medicaid, there's no right. insurance. And so when we move them to this facility, we get to leverage these other dollars and substantially save dollars, and more importantly, help this population recover and get them from cycling on the street and in jail and in hospitals.
Good points all. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with retired Miami-Dade County Judge Steve Lifeman about the Mental Health Center for Criminal Offenders he helped pioneer and which was just granted county approval to open. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So finally, last month, on June 16th, the Miami-Dade County Commission voted to approve the opening of the Miami Center for Mental Health and Recovery next year. Ironically, Commission Chairman Anthony Rodriguez, who had resisted the project, introduced the measure to open it. But he did have some conditions, like an outpatient center to keep better track of patients, substance abuse, as well as mental health treatment, independent Jackson healthcare system oversight, for example. Those are all okay with you?
Fine. You know, all the treatment that will be provided in the facility was already planned to be what we call co-occurring treatment. Mm-hmm. Upward 80 to 90% of the population in jail with mental illnesses also has a substance use disorder. So all of our treatment covers both, but I appreciate the chairman's interest. I appreciate him taking this issue on, and I appreciate him passing it. So if that was what needed to be mm-hmm. done to get it passed, it's totally fine.
But one of the concerns about this, as I said, two-decade-long delay in bringing this center online was that during that time, it could lose things it needed, like money that needs to be raised, because you lose credibility in the project over this delay.
We did lose a lot of money.
Yeah. How much?
At least $1.5 million.
Uh-huh.
The city of Miami had allocated $1.5 million in ARPA funds, and we were not able to use those dollars because there was a timeline on those mm-hmm. dollars. So frustrating. And we stopped fundraising through our not-for-profit foundation until we knew the facility was going to open.
Now, the commission also warned at the meeting last month that there could be funding deficits for this center a few years down the road, as much as $12 million, if you and its supporters can't find new money for it, and Miami-Dade County's already strained budget may not be able to make up that shortfall. How big a challenge is that going to be for you moving ahead?
So we're very aware, and we appreciate it. But again, right now the county is spending $57 million a year and overtime in the jail. Mm-hmm. And it's because we don't have enough corrections officers, and they're paying a lot of extra money. So you have two choices.
So that could take some of that pressure
off. Of course.
Budgetary pressure.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you significantly reduce, again, the number of people left in the jail, you may not have to pay that level of overtime, and you could shift those dollars over to help fund this. Plus, we're going to be studying this. We already have a contract with the University of Miami. They have an amazing population health department. Mm-hmm. We will, and they have this phenomenal, she's a health economist that will be doing this work. We will know exactly what it costs not to treat this population, to treat this population, and what, if any, savings there really are by putting together a system that stops this incredible cycling.
Now, you are also involved with the Homeless Trust in Miami-Dade County. That's another important facet of this. How is all this whole apparatus going to affect or improve the homelessness situation in Miami-Dade County?
The Miami-Dade and the Homeless Trust and Ron Book and Vicky Millett have done an amazing, amazing job over the last 10, 15 years. We have reduced homelessness from over 8,000 to just under 1,000. Those 1,000 that are left on the street are primarily people with serious mental illnesses and color courage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we keep a lot of data here in Dade. We're much more sophisticated than people probably want to give us credit for. But we get a list every single day in the jail who is eligible to be diverted. We took that list, and just to give you an idea why we know this is going to work, over the last 5 years, the top 1,046 people spent 317,000 days in the Dade County Jail. More than 60% of those people are also on the homeless management information list. Okay, so we will be targeting this small but very expensive population and getting them off the street, because it's the same person that goes to the jail and the hospital at enormous, enormous
cost. So people don't realize how criminal offense, homelessness, substance abuse, and mental illness all intersect.
1,000%. And the reason we haven't been able to get to that last 1,000 is because there was no services or capacity available for them anywhere in the United States.
And that's what this center does.
And that's what this center does. Because when community mental health was designed in the United States, the most acutely ill were still in state hospitals.
Right.
And so we closed the hospitals, put them out in the street, and there was nothing really for them.
But for now, this mental health center you've worked so hard to realize will now open. How does finally crossing this finish line make you feel, especially knowing that this facility is, as I said, the first of its kind and could become a model for the country, if not the world?
It's exhilarating, but it's also an amazing reflection of Miami-Dade County. I mean, I'm on an airplane almost every week somewhere in the United States, helping them restructure. Several of them have sent architects to Miami to look at the facility, but it has to be part of a bigger process. Mm-hmm. You can't just build this and fix it. We did everything else already, and so it's the last group, the most expensive group, that this facility will focus on.
Steve Lifeman is a retired Miami-Dade County judge and longtime advocate for mental health treatment in the criminal justice system. The first of its kind mental health treatment center for diverting criminal offenders, which he championed, will open next year. Judge Lifeman, many thanks and congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, the U.S. lost, but the World Cup is still winning us over, especially here in Miami. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. If you support the U.S. men's national soccer team, Monday night was a gut punch and a reality check. Despite President Trump's controversial intervention to get its top scorer reinstated, the U.S. was knocked out of the Men's Soccer World Cup in embarrassing fashion by Belgium, 4-1, as called here by Fox Sports.
It is a disastrous third goal to concede to Belgium.
We're left asking why U.S. soccer still can't compete with the world's elite. But then, many of the South American sides we love here in South Florida, oy, Brazil, also underperformed. Even so, hey, we've got a heck of a quarterfinal game here tomorrow at Hard Rock Stadium between England and Norway. And their fans, like the Scots and Argentines and Uruguayans and Cape Verdeans before them, will no doubt create more carnival in July. Despite the obscene ticket prices, this World Cup, hosted by the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, has been one of the best in memory, from Messi's goals to Vozinha's saves. Are you enjoying this World Cup as much as we are? Maybe not? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is WLRN's digital director and resident soccer scholar, Mateo Sanchez. Matt, how are you?
Great, Tim. Great to be here.
And I'll remind everyone that they can catch WLRN's World Cup coverage at WLRN.org/World Cup 26, or sign up for our weekly soccer edition newsletter at WLRN.org/newsletters. Matt, let's start with the U.S. team's crushing disappointment after such a promising start at this Cup. We've had more than 30 years since the last World Cup in the U.S. to raise our game to the level of the Spains and the Argentinas. Why do we keep failing? I mean, a lot's been written lately, including by us here at WLRN, about how the so-called pay-to-play system of U.S. youth soccer has stunted the player development pipeline in this country. Do we have to change the soccer culture in America if we want to compete?
Look, I think the team has made some progress, but I do think we need a big change. It's kind of happening now, as you reported on, but it's happening too slowly. It's strange, you know, throughout the world, soccer is the sport of the masses, but here in the U.S., it's still an elite sport. The U.S. team is more diverse than it's ever been, but it's still not getting a proper cross-section of society. And the pipeline is not remotely as efficient as that for football or basketball or baseball. So we're not getting the best athletes in the first place trying out and following through with soccer. And the ones who do go through the elite schools, which are very expensive and out of reach for a lot of people, those schools kind of focus on winning now and immediate success rather than developing the talent and the creativity of the players, which you really need at a young age. And it's kind of the key to ultimate success, as we've seen in the World Cup, right?
Yeah, there was a great article in the Wall Street Journal this morning about how Norway, their, you know, kids, you know, youth soccer culture doesn't focus on winning at all costs. It's just about having fun. And look where they are playing, in the semifinals tomorrow.
Yeah, and we're not making as much progress as we should at this point, Yeah, that says it all.
And just quickly, Matt, how ugly a mark did President Trump's intervention to get Phalerin Balogun back into the U.S. lineup for the Belgian game leave on this World Cup and on U.S. soccer's and on soccer's international governing body, FIFA, and its president, Gianni Infantino?
Look, those of us who follow soccer and sports in general have seen a lot of questionable stuff over the years, but this one was almost surreal. I mean, it's hard to think of a more extraordinary political interference in this or any sport. I mean, it's completely against the spirit of the game and FIFA's own rules. And you have to say contributed to the shambolic performance of the US team, and that heavy defeat you mentioned. Infantino will bounce back. He always seems to, but for the U.S. men's team, and I think for the U.S. as a whole, it was a huge on goal because so much international goodwill had been rebuilt at a time when there isn't a lot out there.
Right. Now, I should correct myself. I said that tomorrow's game is the semifinal. It's actually the quarterfinal, just a correction there. And while we're on the subject of controversies, Matt, let's look at the ones we were most concerned about before this World Cup even started, like those millionaire ticket prices and fears about ICE raids at match stadiums. How have those panned out?
There's always some controversies right before these big events, but it seems like we had more than usual for this one. The prices, I mean, you've seen it, right? The games have been wonderful for those watching on their couches, but for the fans who like to go to the games and travel the world, the pricing that FIFA set has been brutal. You know, I usually go to 5 or 6 games when I go to a World Cup, and I've traveled far for it and paid a lot of money for everything. But now this happening in our own backyard, and I can only really afford to go to one.
And Matt,
it's become an elite event.
Yeah, Matt, you remember how much I told you I paid for a ticket in the 1994 World Cup?
Yes.
$25.
Right. That's crazy, even with the current inflation, right? So it's a real shame, you know? But on the other thing that we talked about a lot was the politics and political interference. We mentioned just now an awful bit of political interference, but there was a lot of fears about mass ICE arrests at games. We haven't seen reports of that, but the travel bans that affected some of the nations and the fans of the nations competing in this event, that has happened. You know, we saw a referee not allowed in the country. We saw that the Iran team, who played really, really well, were really hurt by some travel restrictions. So there's been not as much as we feared, but there's been some of that too.
But it wasn't just the U.S. that underachieved in this tournament. As I mentioned, with the exception of the legendary Lionel Messi in Argentina, teams from Latin America bombed out, including your beloved Brazil. So I think we can ask too, why is soccer not just in this country, but in this hemisphere, underperforming so badly on the world stage?
Well, Tim, you had to mention Brazil twice already. It seems, with the exception of Argentina, and that might be, you know, chiefly due to the exceptional talent of Messi, South American football is kind of getting left behind. You know, Paraguay had a huge upset against Germany, so shout out to them. But for Brazil and other countries, I think players are being exported earlier than they have. So they're not getting that kind of development we talked about that they used to get with the, you know, South American style of play that brought so much success in the past. So that might be a reason. But I know for Brazil specifically, it was, you know, there's a lot of the preparations were a mess. We got a new coach only a year or so ago, so that the general messiness of football in South America is playing a role, I think.
How much so? Also, the fact that, you know, the leagues in Latin America are so much, you know, I don't know, so much more underdeveloped than the leagues you see in Europe, for example.
Yeah, that does affect it. Although, you know, a lot of the players who play for the national side, they do play in the European leagues. But then it leads to kind of a detachment from your nation, you know.
Exactly. I mean, the fact that they don't feel any incentive to play in the leagues in their own countries and have to go to Europe, that would seem to leave, you know, the national teams in Latin America a little bereft somehow, no?
Yeah, no, I think that has to play a role in it. That's just getting more and more pronounced.
You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Mateo Sanchez about the highs and the lows of a men's soccer World Cup that Miami and South Florida have played such a big part in. Call us if you want to join us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Matt, let's pivot to the uplifting stories of this World Cup, and there are lots of them. First of all, we've watched a lot of soccer legends do probably their last cup dance here. Messi, Portugal's Ronaldo, Croatia's Modric, Brazil's Neymar. How badly are they going to be missed? And are the younger stars like the Kylian Mbappes and Erling Haalands, are they adequately filling those GOAT shoes?
I think that dynamic and that confluence of things you just mentioned is certainly a big part of why this World Cup has been so exciting and so special. Those guys you mentioned will certainly be missed. It seemed like a pretty strong generation that had, you know, Messi and Ronaldo in it. But for the likes of Ronaldo, you know, and his performances of late, and Neymar and their effect that they have on the team at this point, I think it was time for them to move on and let others come in. As you say, the likes of Haaland and Kane and Mbappe have really shown up with a lot of goals and a lot of power. So I think it's a nice changing of the guard that's happening.
No, that's a good point. And, you know, we don't want a gerontocracy taking over soccer either. Who, though, is going to win the cup's golden boot? You know, meaning, you know, the top scorer in the tournament.
Oh, the Golden Boot chase has been sensational this time around. So often the big players don't quite deliver, but we're seeing all of the big strikers scoring a lot of goals, which is helped, of course, by having more games than ever. But I think you can't see past France going all the way and Mbappe alongside them, you know, getting the Golden Boot. Although, you know, I would like to see Kane do pretty well for England too.
Yeah, because you've also got quite an emotional attachment to England as well, right, Matt?
Correct. And it's nice for them to be playing such a big game in Miami. So, yeah, they're my team now that Brazil have left and the
Well,
US.
there you go. There you go. I mean, it's good to have those options.
Certainly.
We were talking earlier about the US and Latin American teams underachieving at this World Cup, but the bigger story seems to be the teams that overachieved. You've mentioned the African teams, for example, to me earlier, but tiny countries like Cape Verde and their plucky goalkeeper, Vozinha, left a dramatic impression. Does that seem to vindicate FIFA's decision to expand the World Cup from 32 to 48 teams, do you think?
I think that debate is over, Tim. When we talk about the controversies before the tournament, that was one of the big ones. And I certainly was against the expansion. I didn't think we needed to bring in so many teams, arguably of a lower level. But it has produced so much excitement, so much color. And, you know, a wonderful story like Cape Verde probably wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for that, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's a story of the tournament. They came in, they won everybody's hearts with their incredible performances, you know, including two games in Miami and possibly the goal of the tournament against Argentina in Miami, which produced just some incredible images. So
that was a gorgeous goal. We've got Vanessa in Miami on the line. Vanessa, I guess you too were disappointed in the U.S. Performance. How are you? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
I'm great. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
So I was actually very excited about the U.S. performance until the interference.
The interference you're referring to of President Trump.
President Trump, okay. You know, interfering in the whole, you know, their process.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it, you know, hurt the whole team. I think the lack of integrity of the coach not saying, look, we're not putting him in regardless of what President Trump did. Mm-hmm. And it's not bad that they lost because it would have been like a big black mark on the U.S. if we would have won the whole
But Vanessa, game. Do you feel that if Balogun hadn't been allowed to play because of that red card situation, that perhaps the U.S. team would have been a little more driven against Belgium, that we would have seen a little bit more of an energetic performance by them?
I absolutely think we would have seen more of an energetic performance, and I think the fact that they put him in really dampened their performance because, I mean,
And in turn, maybe turbocharged Belgium's performance, no?
And absolutely, yeah, because it's not fair. It really isn't fair. You know, I was so excited about the U.S. team, and it's not fair that they did that. And it had to hurt the integrity of the motivation of the team.
Well, Vanessa, thanks very much for your call. But, Matt, the other really wonderful facet of this World Cup, especially for us here in Miami, has been the fans from all over the world strutting their stuff and bringing the world together the way soccer is supposed to. What have been your favorite moments and images in that regard?
Yeah, as we said, you know, although the pricing really meant some fans couldn't make it to the games, the expansion, I think, did bring some let's say, hungry football fans who hadn't been to a World Cup for a while. I think the Tartan Army from Scotland and the Norwegian fans that have won a lot of people's hearts, they hadn't been to the World Cup for a while.
And mention why the Norwegian fans have won everybody's hearts.
Well, the rowing, right?
The Viking thing, yeah.
The Viking row that's been taking place everywhere, yeah. Even after Brazil lost to Norway, I can acknowledge that is a pretty special and pretty cool celebration. So, yeah, I think it's been really special with the fans. It's a big part of the World Cup, is the carnival of color and cultures. And I think the U.S. fell in love with these fans. And I think also many of those fans did fall in love with the U.S. The diasporas in the U.S. really showed up as well. You know, they packed out stadiums and bars and represented.
A lot of them discovered ranch dressing. Yeah.
Yes, that's been one of the big takeaways, it seems.
Mateo Sanchez is WLRN's digital director and resident soccer scholar. Matt, many thanks. And again, you can catch WLRN's World Cup coverage at WLRN.org/World Cup 26. Finally on the roundup, something those World Cup fans love to do is trade and collect panini, stickers emblazoned with soccer players and team crests. WLRN's Elisa Ramos and Sherilyn Cabrera hung out with them in Doral.
So, for example, this is Mexico 8.
For Nico Kuzak, he spent roughly $500 on stickers this World Cup.
Some people might think it's childish. Some people might think it's like, yeah, only like, you know, kids do it or you're wasting money. I think in the grand scheme of things, it's something that you always look back fondly on it.
Panini stickers have been a part of the World Cup fan experience since 1970. When Kuzak was younger, his cousins in Argentina got him hooked on it.
The act of opening up the sticker album, it's like this unique sense of euphoria combined with nostalgia that you're just like, you don't really get in too many places, you know? You start feeling like a little kid again.
Everyone has their own way of sorting, tracking, and trading their stickers. Some people rely on apps to track their progress. Others still do it the old-fashioned way, with pen and paper. Kuzak made his own Excel spreadsheet. He has kept all of his past Panini albums since 2010.
I would love to do this with my kids.
And our kids are what it's all about. Thanks again to WLRN's Elisa Ramos and Sherilyn Cabrera. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Katie Munoz and Denise Royal. Denise is the senior producer of content streaming and news products. Katie is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is WLRN's digital director. Sergio Bustos is our vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.